You're listening to the AHDB podcast, farming news and stories from across the UK.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this podcast on direct selling of red meat. I'm firstly going to speak to Andy Rumming, who is a suckler beef farmer from Wiltshire, and then later on we'll hear from Carl Pendlebury. So, morning, Andy. Thank you very much for speaking to us. You've a bit more going on than just farming sucklers down in Wiltshire, don't you? So do you want to start by giving us an overview of what you are up to before we get down to the nitty-gritty of direct selling?
Yeah, sure. So we've got about, 90 suckler cows, and we farm a total of about 150 hectares. There's the farm that I'm at here at Waterhay, which is just between Swindon and Cirencester in North Wiltshire. And then my brother and father are just down the road, about 8 miles away. It's all one business, but they've got half the land there. And we're now at a system where we're doing all the breeding over here. So all the sucking cows are here. They're in two herds of about 45 each, one calving in March, April, one lot calving in August and September. And upon weaning, they all head over to my brother's at Park Farm. I'd just add that we're Pasture for Life certified, so we're doing lots of mob grazing, lots of rotational grazing, and we're not feeding any hard feed concentrates, anything like that.
By your beef enterprise, have you got other bits and pieces going on?
Yeah, so we've got a turkey business, so really spearheaded by my brother, but I'm pretty involved. And so we sell 500 free-range bronze turkeys every Christmas. And that's really good. And that's had quite a big bearing on what I'm doing with the beef. My sister-in-law has a pedigree Oxford Downs, and they're thriving. And I'm just starting a glamping business, which I'm working hard on, ready for next season. So we're kind of diversifying more and more, but the cattle are the kind of anchor in the centre of the whole thing.
Perfect. Okay, let's get down to the purpose of the podcast then. Direct selling, talk us through from the beginning. So why, what made you decide that that might be a viable option for your business?
Well, to start with, it was economics. So when I started about 5 years ago, we were selling heavy stores at market. We were using a Hereford bull, which, nice bull, but no EBVs. And it was producing quite a range of animals out of crossbred mothers. So the suckler cows are Hereford cross themselves. They've got quite a lot of Belgian blue and Friesian influence because a lot were bought from our neighbouring organic dairy farmer. But we were actually, some of the animals we're only getting £700 for, and they were pushing 30 months. And so this was economically really not good. But also some of them were pretty much fit. And I knew they were coming off a good system that was, grass-based, grazing lots of interesting stuff. And so I felt that we were definitely losing money. And two, we probably had a premium product that was just getting lost in amongst commodity beef.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, it's like you say, when you've got a premium product, it's doing something a bit different with it, isn't it? So when you decided to go down that route then, what were the very first things that you did?
Well, so the first things I did was to look at local abattoirs and where I could get an animal slaughtered and someone who would pack the meat and get it back to me. So I looked around, and in our area was effectively one really quite close, probably about 5 or 6 miles away, and then two or three getting on for sort of, 45 minutes to an hour away. And so I rang them up, got prices. They were quite different in prices, and also did a bit of research on them. And yeah, that was not entirely straightforward, but I was amazed at the difference in price and the difference in customer service, let's put it that way, what they were prepared to do. So that's the first thing I did. The second thing, I was trying to work out how much retail value was in an animal. And so I sent off for the HDB sell your own beef pack, which had some calculators and some bits in it. And then I guess the third thing I did was to start work out who I would sell it to. And I already knew that, due to the success of the turkeys, that people were out there. I was pretty sure that people would buy it, but I couldn't just email the turkey list because it was not the same business at that point. It was something I was doing myself. So my brother was happy to send some messages out saying that contact myself, but we weren't at that point able to just use the email list for this enterprise, which was, I thought, was going to be a real problem.
Yeah. So have you had to change your product to suit what your customers want, or were you already producing a product that you thought they were after?
So Hereford Cross, Hereford Beef, some of the major multiples have got Hereford as a sort of a brand and as a premium brand. So I was pretty sure that we had some of the right genetics and that we would have potentially good eating quality. The thing I was less sure on was about fanned confirmation and how to make sure I got the right animals. So I did a live to dead day. In fact, I did two of them. And that was really useful because we were really only used to looking at what we thought were heavy stalls. And we didn't have any animals that were tech, and we didn't sell anything dead weight, or we didn't have anything that we absolutely knew was, you know, an R4L. So that was a bit of a learning curve. I guess really, I knew that I just had to jump in and do it. And I think there's always reasons why it isn't perhaps quite the right time. You don't have quite everything to your fingertips, but sometimes you've just got to do it. And to be quite honest, there's not many barriers to selling a beef animal. You know, there's not huge barriers to doing it. You can find the abattoir, if you can find somewhere that will cut it and pack it well, that's a start. The worst case that can happen is that you're going to have to buy a freezer, fill it, and eat it yourself. That's not too bad. So on the with lambs, it's obviously even slightly simpler because they're smaller. So I didn't think it was too risky. And I think that's important in any new enterprise. You don't want to be risking a lot. The other thing is that it is, if you can find the right abattoir and the right people to do the cutting and packaging, you're not having to do any capital investment. And I was adamant that I was keen to sweat other people's assets to start with. And I didn't want to be investing anything, really. And I was also lucky in that, because we had the turkey enterprise, we did have a big fridge. So I knew that I could bring the product to farm, had room in a big fridge to hold it, and then I could organize distribution from there, and that was helpful. But I know that there's lots of people who don't even do that. They either get it all out on the day it comes back, or they freeze it all. So there's, you know, even that side of things, you can kind of work out some.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask, actually, because when we speak to Carl later on, we're going to cover off like the cold chain, basically, and what you need for various different versions of direct selling, so to speak. So you, the abattoir slaughters and butchers, and then you pop it in your fridge and it goes out from there. How do you get it from butcher to home? Because that there has to be an element of obviously chilling there, doesn't there?
So We've kind of moved on a bit now, but when we started, the cutting facility was associated with the abattoir. So essentially, I took the live animal to the abattoir, and then I visited 4 weeks later their butcher's shop, and I collected all the boxes of vacuum-packed meat that were all then boxed up. I took that in my own car that was clean back to our fridge. And so it was out of the fridge for about 45 minutes, which is allowable under the legislation. So no, you're right. You've got to think about these things. And there's actually quite a difference about doing it in the winter to the summer. It's 30 degrees.
That makes a bit of a difference.
Yeah. I mean, meat does have quite a lot of thermal mass, but you don't want to break down or get caught in a traffic jam. But then again, it might be that they can deliver. And all of this, you've got to look, you know, how much is your time worth? It was a 2.5 or 3 hour round trip all in all, plus £15 worth of petrol. And if they'll deliver it back to you for 30 quid, 40 quid, that's probably worth it.
Yeah.
So again, when choosing abattoirs and catching rooms, you know, you can't ask too many questions. Ask all of these things about logistics. And also try and find other people that have used them. Someone will always have a negative story about every single abattoir or cutting plant. And you just got to use your own sense to work out whether that, you know, is a problem or whether the good stories outnumber the bad story. So you're never going to find a perfect record for anywhere.
Yeah, no, that's grand. So just quickly on legislation, because Carl's going to go through it in more detail later, but have you got any top tips on who to speak to make sure that you get in the legislation and you're everything right?
So your local environmental health officer, which will be employed by your unitary district or county council, and they will give you advice, and you should also register as a food business. Now, that is worth doing, and then they're aware of you, etc. Now, each EHO, they all operate to basically the same rules, but some of them are a lot busier than others. And if you're just essentially taking packaged meats and then selling your own meat to a small group of customers, I think it's normally seen as low risk. I don't think it's something to be afraid of. And I found we did have an existing relationship due to our turkeys. And so that was really useful. And nowadays they encourage you to be part of the kind of scores on the doors thing. So my tiny shed here with two freezers in and a fridge has got 5 stars. But then it was actually really quite simple for me to get that, because it's a very simple package product that is very different to running a cutting room or a meat processing plant.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I found them really helpful. They're also really helpful on labelling, stuff like that.
Perfect. Okay. Just quickly then, just regarding packaging and branding. So you said in the early days it was coming back vacuum packed from the abattoir. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And the labelling then, did you have, so obviously there'll be a standard label that comes from the abattoir and the butchery of the animal. Did you add anything to that label, or in terms of branding your product?
Yeah. So the initial labels back from the cutting plant were really basic, and felt that it was too basic. So it's essentially the type of cut, so for example, top side, and the weight. And whilst that's two really useful bits of information, it didn't show any of my branding, and it didn't actually meet the criteria that you need to sell meat to the public. You've got to put a contact name and address on there, you've got to have a batch number, and you've got to have used by or best before dates. And there's also meant to be a particular font size. Again, talk to EHO for the latest information on that.
So they were labelling it then as if it was for your consumption.
They effectively were. That's right. And so, but also, so apart from the legal issues, a label, you know, every label that you've got in your customer's fridge or freezer is like an advert. It's a little advertising option. Yeah. And I know they've already purchased by that point, but there's nothing, you know, it's your duty to kind of reinforce that message to get that next purchase. So I quite rapidly bought a very, very basic little label printer, which was great. It was about 70 quid, thermal label printer, and a little brother one, and basically printed my own labels that were on demand, and they cost pence. So I don't have to, haven't paid any expensive fees, but it allows me to get my logo, the legislative information, and a bit more information. It is quite labour intensive, and I'm still using that process. It is labour intensive in the fact that I have to handwrite the weights on each amount. So for joints that are variable, someone has to weigh them and write that on. But at the moment, it's still the cost-effective method. You can get weigher labellers, which you basically put on, like you might see on a deli counter, and they spit out a label, and they're great. But they start from about £1,200, and that's before you've had your labels designed So to invest in that sort of kit, you're going to have to invest about £2,500. And we're on the cusp of doing that now. We've just got to actually do it. So no, I would say go, you know, invest the minimum to start with, get a simple label printer, get your brand on there.
Perfect. Okay. If anybody's interested in knowing exactly what needs to go on a label, Carl will cover that later on and where you can find that information. Just before we move on then to marketing, Andy, because that's something that you do really well with your business and it deserves a bit of time. Just tell us where you are now then in terms of butchery. I believe you're butchering your own.
So we had the facilities. So we had a big fridge for turkeys. And we had, so it was a converted herringbone milking parlour. We filled in the pit. We put a couple of fridges in where the pit was and some stainless steel tables. And then in the area where the bulk tank was, we got rid of that. And we used that for the actual turkey butchery at Christmas. So we've just upgraded it by small investments. Everything's been sort of secondhand, done ourselves. And so we've now got it to a stage where we're allowed to butcher our own carcasses and meat in our own premises. So we now get the quarters delivered back to us from the abattoir. We then hang them for 3 or 4 weeks, and then I get a butcher to come in and help me break them down and get them full all the way to retail packaging. I would, if you're starting this from scratch, don't even think about investing in a cutting room. That is really, you have to be doing, you're just doing beef, you have to do so many bodies of beef to make that worth it. I you know, look at working with others way before you get to that stage. The only way it works for us is that, one, the building was spare, two, we've got the turkeys going through it, and I guess three, that we've done it very gradually over time. But it would cost, you know, probably 50,000 plus to build that facility from scratch, and yeah, that's an awful lot of beef that you have to put through, yeah, to cover.
In the early days then, when you weren't breaking down your own carcasses, roughly how many cattle a year would go through the abattoir for this purpose?
So we started off doing basically one every 2 months. Mm-hmm. So 6 a year, and we did that for probably 2 years, partly because I was still working full-time off the farm. And I was more interested, and I think I still am, in getting everything right than just pursuing maximum throughput.
Yeah.
And so we're now up to 2 animals a month, and that's 2 every month. And there's probably demand to go towards 3.
Okay.
I haven't pushed growth super hard. It's mainly been organic growth, and I'd rather have a short waiting list of customers than have, you know, freezers full of beef.
Full of beef, yeah. And have you had to think about the way you're finishing your cattle to meet that sort of throughput demand? I know you mentioned that you were now spring and autumn block. Has that got anything to do with your direct selling business? Or
No, that hasn't. That's just something that's always happened at the farm long before I came back. It kind of makes really good use of bulls, but it is extra groups to manage. But from a supply point of view, for direct marketing, it's great. So we have animals all the year round. Originally, I started by taking what I would call overfat, and they were ones that would get penalized most at market, but ironically were probably the best eating quality because they had loads of marbling. But what I've found out now, we've actually done a lot of work on our genetics to improve our genetics. We've got our grazing sorted out, and so our cattle are now better. And having our own on-farm butchery, what we now know is that actually we get, it's more economically viable for us to slaughter and butcher better cattle than ones that are, I guess, what the industry would call out of spec. There's a huge financial difference in terms of the retail meat yield from an in-spec animal at the right dead weight to one that is overfat and, yeah, underweight.
Yeah.
Okay. Just on the economics, I think it's worth mentioning. So what I would aim for each animal, so we're looking at ideally a 320 kilogram carcass, that's dead weight, and I would aim for £2,500 of income off that carcass. Some will be a bit less. Some big steers will be significantly more. So that's what I'm aiming for. But an out of spec animal could be as little as, I think I had one that did 1,600 pounds, and that is right on the, you know, there's probably 100 quid's profit there.
Yeah.
So I do think it's a very good point. If you want to do it, you do also have to look carefully at your animals, and looking at it as a route for out-spec animals is not really a long-term solution.
You're utilising the whole carcass as well, though, aren't you, Andy? Because you've got an outlet for the offal as well.
Yeah. So I was keen to sell the offal because I didn't like to think it was going to waste, and it's part of the deal. When you get an animal slaughtered, the offal is, I think, in all cases considered yours, but many farmers don't pick it up. So essentially, I normally manage to sell it all, and it's worth about 100 quid, which is significant. It does mean another trip to the abattoir on the day of slaughter to collect it, because I like to get it super fresh. But at the moment, we're doing two animals at a time, so there's a little economies of scale there. And there's a big trend. You know, there's quite I'd say offal is going up in people's appreciation, especially to the paleo and sort of carnivore diet people. Even if you don't eat those types of things yourself, definitely advertise it and see what people like.
And people are buying that separately rather than as part of a, say, a meat box or something. They specifically are wanting the offal. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I run a separate little email list of offal fans, and I send that to them. And there is some crossover, but there are some people who are really keen on it.
Okay, perfect. Right, well, that brings us nicely onto marketing. So I know when we were chatting before the podcast, it's something that you are very passionate about, isn't it? Selling your story and selling your product, right? Just talk us through what you do in terms of marketing and how it works for you.
Well, I guess my key channel is email. So there's, you know, social media is great, print magazines and local magazines, that's all fine. But the route, you know, if you can get a potential customer's email address and send them a message direct to their inbox with most of your buying customers, that is a really, really good message of communicating direct to them. So I collect email addresses by having a little form on the website and directing people to that. And I guess I use social media to direct people to that form. And then also, if we have on-farm events or other events, I kind of have a pen and paper and get people to write down their email address. So I think that's really important as my kind of route. And I use MailChimp, which is a free-to-use web-based package, which basically you can keep all your email addresses in, and then it lets you email out newsletters. And, you know, most people nowadays sign up for newsletters from HDB or their favorite shoe supplier or whatever. And they, all these companies are using platform to get that message out to you. It's got a couple of real benefits. So firstly, if you try sending lots of emails from your own personal account, your internet service provider at some point will probably put a stop to that. And then secondly, things like MailChimp give you a lot of analytics. So I can see how many people opened my message, how long they took to read it, where they were in the world, what operating system they were using, whether they were using a tablet, phone, a huge amount of information which you can use to tell you about how active your people are and sort of what brackets they might fall into. And all of us are giving this information away every time we open an email from HDB or whoever. So yeah, it's really powerful stuff. And it also allows you to put together really kind of rich emails to send your potential customers with photos and links and buttons they can press that emails you directly. So I found it really good. And for the numbers of people I'm emailing, which is a couple of hundred, it's free.
Perfect. If anyone wants to have a look at Andy's website, by the way, it's, if you just Google Andy Rumming Beef, you've got a blog and all sorts on there, haven't you? Just a boring part about collecting people's data. I suppose you've now got to be careful that your GDPR, make sure your GDPR compliant. Does MailChimp do that for you?
Nowadays, most people have to do this two-factor system. So basically, they type in their address and then it sends them an email saying, did you mean to join this? So they, from there, there's that part of it. And then obviously I have to have a statement saying what I am doing with that data and how I'm storing it and how people want to, if they want to be removed from it. And there's some good online resources you can find out there to help you do that. It doesn't need to be overly complicated.
No.
But you do need to look
bear
at that.
It in mind. Yeah. When you were starting out then, Andy, with marketing, did you do any formal training or any courses, or was it just a case of trial and error?
Well, I had, so was really active on Facebook with his turkeys and still is. And so I could see that the way he basically just tells stories about whatever's going on, takes pictures, was live Facebooking from the turkey pen. And so, and people liked it and engaged with it. So he was a really good sort of inspiration. And then also looking online and talking to people, particularly in the Pasture Fed Livestock Association, about how they were doing it was really useful. Sort of pulled together a logo. I got a neighbour to help sort of, I designed it and then he sort of tied it up and made it look presentable and sort of went from there, really. I think it's, again, with any type of marketing, the cost is your time. And so it's the time to take the photographs, crop them, edit them, make them look good, design your website, your flyer, writing your blog, doing all of that. I mean, it does take time and you need good content to put in it. But if you live and work on a farm, you know, you've got content all around you that people like. It's the content is there. You've just got to kind of try and organize yourself to put it in. Yeah. What I also did after a couple of years, I did a course, an online course who specializes in sort of farm marketing. And she was brilliant. And I think it cost about $200, series of several weeks. And that was great. And I think it is, sometimes we're a little bit cautious and perhaps keep our a bit shy to kind of shout about what we're doing and what we've got. And she definitely kind of pushes people to shout about what they've got, but also to be quite organized and to invest your precious time in the areas where you're likely to get the most back. So, yeah, I found her really useful.
You mentioned that you had on-farm events. Are they specifically to promote your beef business, or are they for other things and serve a purpose sort of on the side and added extra?
Well, so I think a lot of... So Yeah, so I guess the bottom line is to sell beef. But the events, and along with I guess blog posts and some emails and some social media, all of that's there to kind of like build the story and build the relationship. And so yes, I'm keen and very active about trying to sell the story, but that doesn't mean I'm trying to always sell beef. On farm events, so farm walks, and we've done, in a normal year, we do quite a few, and we do, most of them are free, and that's just either an hour or a couple of hours walk around the farm at key points in the year. And those people really like coming, and you can definitely correlate. If someone's actually visited the farm on a walk, they buy more and they buy more often. So I think it is an essential USP, if you can, to do it, because, you know, supermarket can't really provide that. They might be able to show a picture of the farm on the packet, but your ability to interact with them and ask them questions, you know, everything from what flowers have you got to, you know, what type of slaughter was happening to the animal is just not there. And so we can do those things, and so therefore it's a really good idea. So we do charge for some on-farm events. So we do a dawn chorus walk, and that's a bit more specialist. It's got a few overheads, but in general, most of them we don't charge for.
So I suppose it's about just about keeping the consumer connected to what they're eating, isn't it? Like you say, supermarkets can't do that. So it's bound to have benefits.
Yeah, that's right. But it's also, again, you've got to keep an eye on your time. All these things do take time to organise, set up beforehand, and then actually kind of marshal and on the day. We had a bit of an issue when they got like really popular. And so now our fertility walks in the spring are ticketed. So the tickets are free, but you have to buy a ticket because we got too many people turning up. And that was stressful for everybody. So again, there's bits. So the website I've got has got like a ticketing and event function, which is dead easy to use. So there's, you know, there's never been a better time to get lots of tools at your disposal to make your life a bit easier.
Do you manage your website, Andy, or do you get somebody external to do that?
I do it myself. So there is a range of, a huge number of different companies where you can just essentially do it yourself. I use Wix, and it costs me, because I've got one that's got a shop on board and pay a bit extra for a few features, I think it costs me about £150 a year. And that is, for me, that's money well spent. I could probably do a lot more with it in terms of search engine optimization, but my market is local, so I don't need it to crop up when someone in London types in grass-fed beef.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered, your top tips for anybody considering starting up either a beef direct selling business or any direct selling business, basically?
As I said, I would just do it. There's never a perfect time. Although I would say probably we're at a more perfect time than there ever has been. Demand is huge, and that demand isn't just for the product itself. It's for actually a slightly different experience, a non-supermarket experience, and that, you know, a bit of reassurance and traceability. So actually, this is a brilliant time to do it. Doesn't matter if there's other people in your area doing it. Diversity in a whole ecosystem of small producers is what we need. So I would say just do it.
Let's take the plunge. Perfect. Okay. Thanks ever so much, Andy, for imparting your wisdom with us. Just a quick one from me. Andy spoke that he'd been on a couple of Live to Dead events. Those events are now called Farm to Forks. And obviously this year we've struggled to run them with COVID, but hopefully they will get up and running next year, and they run all over the country. So just keep an eye out on our website for those events happening if you want to go on one. They take you through the whole process from live animal selection right through the slaughter process. Andy, are they good days?
Yeah. It's as a farmer, even if you're not direct selling, you've got to understand lots more about the whole food business. And this is really revealing. And I found it very, very fascinating.
Brilliant. Love the job. Right. We'll leave it there and we will move on to Carl to get his words of wisdom on the subject. Thank you very much.
So I'm speaking to Carl Pendlebury now. Carl is our senior manager for the quality schemes at AHDB. I'm going to ask Carl to just tell us a bit more about his role at AHDB and his experience in the red meat industry, please.
I'm a senior manager for the quality standard mark. I also look after West Country PGI. The sole purpose of those is to guarantee eating quality in beef and lamb. And it's a really enjoyable role, coming into contact with farmers on occasion, but really dealing with high street butchers, catering butchers, and the food service in general has really broadened the scope of what I aim to achieve, and particularly in food service, where I see that there's a massive chance to actually improve the scope of British being used within that sector. The quality standard mark's been around for around 17 years now, and it's still going from strength to strength, particularly on the high street, where we have over 2,000 high street butchers within the scheme. The butchers are very strong and passionate about promoting produce that's homegrown, and also utilising the marketing kits that we produce, which is butchers' recipe packs, posters, but also the costing and yield guides that are produced by the trade team that they've been a massive bonus through trade and into the high streets.
Brilliant. Love the job. So we spoke to Andy Rumming this morning and he told us his journey from start to finish, or where he is now, should I say, of direct selling to consumers. Can we start again from the beginning with you? So you've got somebody, a farmer, that's thinking that they want to start a direct selling business. What are your tips from your experience that things for things that people really need to consider before they invest any time and money in direct selling?
The real big hits to cover off before putting any knives into any meat, really, is talking to the environmental health and trading standards, ensuring that you're on the same wavelength as those guys. It's really important to be in front of them and not on the back foot. That they can really help you put the whole system in place rather than just coming telling you that you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, okay, so you'd give them a ring before you did anything else.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. The second element to it is ensuring that your chill chain is correct. That is the second biggest, if not becoming the fastest growing non-compliance of all areas. And chill chain is massively important in terms of compliance for the trading standards and those facilities.
Just explain to us what a chill chain is then, just for those of us that don't know.
So the chill chain is keeping your meat product below 7 degrees from point of slaughter or from point of collection that it comes into your ownership again, back out to the consumer, and then it becomes the consumer's responsibility. But all that transit time, it is your responsibility until you actually pass it over to the next person who's purchased it.
Okay. So when we were chatting about this earlier on, you were just talking about the various different options for setting up a meat business. So that won't always be your responsibility, will it, I suppose? If you're what you called, I suppose, the middleman earlier on, that will be the responsibility of the abattoir and the process, or the butcher and the processor.
Correct. Realistically speaking, there's probably three different types or major types of sale for direct selling. Number one is where your animal goes off to slaughter, you take a carcass back and you do the butchery, packing and sales from the farm gate. You're responsible for absolutely everything there apart from the point of drop off to slaughter and then picking the carcass back. It then belongs to the slaughter facility, but everything else is yours. Number two is where you get the animal dropped off at slaughter, it comes through the system, butchers are actually at the slaughterhouse and it's packed at the slaughterhouse, and you bring that back and put it into chillers at home and actually still sell that from the farm gate, that chill chain is still your responsibility until that customer's passed that money over to you and taken it away. And number three is where I would just call you the conduit of sale, where everything is done for you, it's packed into boxes and put into nice packaging, actually at slaughter or at a butcher's shop. You take the money online or somebody comes and visits you. The only element then is that someone else can do the delivery for you, but that's then taken care of by the person who's packed it. So you're just the conduit of money that takes that around there. I think it's really important to understand those three areas so that you can decide for yourself which is more in tune with what your business already is doing, because to actually start a shop up on site is, number one, is time consuming, number two, it's going to attract a lot of visitors to your farm, which is fine, you know, and I don't have anything about people going to farms because I actually like when using my local farm shop and utilizing it there, but it needs to be a safe place for people to visit, and it's not just around that just one area of the shop, because people being people will be very inquisitive and walk all over.
It brings us on nicely to probably the main question that we get asked from farmers, levy payers that are wanting to look into this side of things, is around the legislation. And just going from what you've just said now, there's obviously going to be varying legislations and boxes to tick and licenses to get depending on exactly what you want to do. Am I right in thinking that?
Correct. There's not so much in licenses, but you do need to be in front of the trading standards and the environmental health if you're cutting on site. And actually, it's really important to get your star rating. You know, it's not just about cooked food, the star rating. Any facility could have a 5-star rating given to them because of the food production that's on there.
Yep.
If you're really wanting to be the best in class for that, it's really worth being in front of it and utilising everything that's there. And yes, it's paperwork, yes, it's records, yes, it's keeping all that together, But more importantly, that is also your get out of jail card should something go wrong. It's also your get out of jail card should a consumer come back and say, this has not been quite correct. And, you know, consumers being consumers will come and put challenges in your way. It's not always about complaints. It's not, but they will put challenges directly in your path. And some of those challenges will relate to legalities and making sure that everything around what you're doing is correct. So my real advice is take as much information as you can from all the free sources that are out there, environmental health, trading standards. They're real great sources of that. But also you'll have neighbours that have started shops up and they can offer advice and how to do that and how to liaise with your consumer and actually just understand what type of consumer you want to attract into your farm, into your home in effect, because actually that's really important of what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's as if we've practiced this, Carl. So that leads us on to our next bit, which is knowing your market. You talk about knowing what type of consumer you want to attract. I suppose the offshoot of that is knowing what product you need to produce and what you're going to sell to people. Any tips or thoughts on that?
Most consumers know what they want when they're coming into the farm shop because they're coming for a special occasion or a Sunday lunch or a Sunday dinner. I think what's really important to this is understanding what they require for midweek. If they're coming into you on a Friday, Saturday or Sunday, actually you have the opportunity to provide meat to them as a fresh occasion for the next 3 or 4 days. And that four-quarter meat is what you'll always be left with because they don't really understand how to use it. I think one thing that's really paramount is to actually be able to put that in front of them and say, well, this would be great for a chili, or this would be great for a casserole, or this would be great just to utilise with vegetables. You can put that in your slow cooker. And so it's about having that liaison and understanding what type of customer you want to pull through the door for the animal that you're producing. And you know, you're producing animals now for a certain market because you're taking them to a slaughterhouse and they're going into a commercial trade. Is that commercial trade general retail, or is that a fairly specialist place that it's going? Because actually, you'll not want to upset that trade for the one or two animals a month that are going to go through the actual farm shop. The farm shop is boosting that income and not actually taking over the enterprise. So you need to understand that market so that you get the right customer coming through the gate to buy what you're actually producing now.
Yep. Absolutely. Just on about producing what the consumer wants, we have this conversation with farmers quite a lot of the time. When you're looking at consumers that buy from farm shops opposed to supermarkets, what sort of fat content are they looking for? Is it the same as everybody else? Are they the guys that like a little bit more, or what's the crack with that?
It does depend on where and what they're going to use it for. So if you've got consumers that are coming in that are scratch cooking, they'll really, and by scratch cooking, I mean cooking with ingredients and herbs and spices and not just buying kits to put in there. They'll look at meat and pick it on the quality. They particularly like a bit more marbling, but not external fat. External fat's a little bit out of fashion, and that's been driven by the big retailers. So I would say no more than 10 millimetres on the outside, and that can go right across all species. That's not just to pertain to one, but beef, lamb and anything else that's out there. But then when you get somebody coming into the springtime and through the summer and particularly autumn time that's looking at barbecues, they definitely want some fat around it because that's actually what bases it over those hot coals and really keeps it succulent as it soaks the way through along with the marbling that's coming out of the system. And it's no harm when you're serving people. It's just to remind them that the resting period after cooking is equally as important as the cook itself. And that actually will allow that moisture to start coming back that's been driven to the centre of the muscle, start to come back out and make it succulent and tasty.
So if we move on a little bit towards presentation and packaging, I suppose, we had a question the other day about, well, it's a bit back to regulations on labelling. Where would you find what your regulations on labelling need to be for depending on the route to market that you're going for?
Irrespective of route, I would expect the label to be a minimum standard anyway. So irrespective of whether it's your slaughterhouse putting that on there, the butcher or yourself, And there's a great document out there that's called the Food Information Regulations. That was created in 2014. So if you are searching that, if you put FIR 2014, it'll pop up. The document itself's only about 40 pages, but there's only two pages in there that pertain to meat sales and meat labelling. So it's not a big onerous read, but that is really important because that's really what's expected to be labelled on the pack.
Okay. And then if we talk about just about packaging and what consumers like the meat that they're buying to look like, do you want to just touch on sort of vacuum packaging versus other forms of packaging and how that might affect sales?
Dependent on what your actual throughput is will depend on really what the packaging needs to be. You know, I think that that's really important that you understand what your throughput's going to be. So most consumers are very happy with the vac pack system, a vacuum pack. To actually put it into what you see in supermarkets on a cardboard backing with a skin on top, skin packing, is quite expensive. A vac pack will give you approximately 10 days shelf life. So once you get that back out of the original chill chain, if yours is really consistent and can guarantee it under there, you can extend that slightly dependent on the view of the slaughter facility or the butcher packing it. But 10 days is really where the lifespan is of a vac pack. If you were then take that out of the vacuum pack to sell it, so you've got it back as a big primal and then reclassify it, actually that then takes it down to 3 days. That's your maximum from there. So once you've opened it, it's 3 days and then a waste. If you have fresh sale, you can take that out and you've got 3 days again to sell that, but then you can sort of put 2 or 3 days on that for the consumer going out the other side. So it does vary dependent on how good the vacuum is, how good the packaging is, and only your supplier can actually tell you that because they'll have the actual analytics to show that and they've done the test on that and the shelf life testing. So it's really important that you have all that information to hand and also then what your consumer's requiring. And you know, if you've got a good vacuum pack and somebody comes in this week, you might only see them in a fortnight because they can buy enough product in one go that they're not coming back every few days, that they're going to be there for the next 10 days and then you can put that out again the following weekend.
Perfect. Okay. So just talking then, thinking about getting a carcass processed, if you're not going to be butchering your own carcasses on farm and you getting a butcher to do it for you and package it, how is there a standard that a carcass is butchered to? How flexible is it in terms of if you think you want mince in 2 pound packages or, you know, sirloins in packs of 4 or whatever? How flexible are butchers in that respect?
The slaughter facility and butchers are really flexible in how they'll package it for you. They'll do whatever you want, really, within reason. Bear in mind that every time you put a knife into a carcass, it's a cost. So there'll be a minimum cost, which will say, example, £100, which will split that down and package that up into consumable packages. And then if you want it into smaller packages than that, it might be that they charge you for the extra packaging and a little bit of time that goes around that to do that, which is not really unreasonable to do. It's just about coming to that relationship of this is what this is cost and this is... It's about developing an open relationship with the people that you're working with. The actual cutting and packaging, we can help with specifications. We've got the meat purchasing guide, which is a full guide of all the cuts that come out. We also have a web page, which is direct selling beef, which is on the AHDB website. And we can supply the link, which I'm sure will be in the blurb. But on there as well, there's beef and lamb. We are looking at pork as well. And it gives a demonstration of how to do the calculations on profit, how to utilize the carcass and the cuts that we suggest that actually split this into small, medium and large boxes so that you actually utilize the carcass as a whole rather than having items left, which is another concept of actually marketing that animal rather than just straight over a counter all the time and the potential of the forequarter being left intact.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, Cal. What's your best tip for it, ensuring that you get whole carcass utilisation? Because it's a bit different, isn't it, when you're direct selling. Like you said, you don't want to be left with just the fore quarter. Would you advise people to start to sell in boxes at first, or do you think go for it and sell individual cuts?
I would definitely say boxes is it to start off with, because the boxes and the boxes that have been suggested by Martin and Dick the Butchers at AHDB actually utilize the whole carcass, and then there's an Excel spreadsheet there that you can put all your inputs in, your outputs, and it'll generate the profit for you so that you can actually see how that goes on. And that you're actually making a profit out of it, rather than just thinking that you need to charge a price.
Yeah,
it'll go right across the board, and then you can utilize the actual pricing guide for each of the muscles. And then as you start to progress through that and selling individual muscles and breaking the carcass more, actually you can work it out on a muscle by muscle piece, so that you know actually you're not breaking the bank for the consumer, but you're still making a healthy profit. But likewise, you're not stepping out of line with what your local area is actually doing, and you're still within that competition.
Yeah. Okay. So you're not pricing yourself out of the market.
Yeah.
So whilst we're on the subject then of tools and resources that AHDB have got, we've loads of stuff, haven't we? What else have we got that to help people?
We produce the recipe packs. So we produce recipes 3-4 times a year, which has got 3 or 4 recipes in there. And they could use those to put those in. That usually comes out as a notification through the comms into LevyPayer comms. It's just about dropping an email to butcherskit@ahdb.org.uk, and we'll sell that. We can send those out at any time of year, but those kits are specific as we move through the year, but they're just as equally as good by the self at any time, apart from the Christmas ones, which are Christmas
specific. Excellent. Okay, just quickly then, before we finish, we get a lot of questions about marketing your product, which is a huge topic in itself and something we'll look to do separately in the future. But top 3 tips for marketing your products, what are the absolute do's and don'ts of marketing?
Know your customer, keep yourself legal, enjoy what you do.
Okay, and we've got pictures and images and image libraries and all sorts of things, haven't we, that people can access as well. I'll give you the links to those at the end. And perfect. Okay, just before we finish then, Carl, is there anything else that you think we need to tell people about direct selling, anything burning a hole in your pocket?
I would just reiterate the important factor of chill chains, taking along trading standards and environmental health, and actually enjoy the journey, because consumers know the people that are enjoying liaising with them, talking to them, inspiring them to use this product, you know. And when you've produced that on a farm, there's nobody better to enthuse them. You've got it walking around the field, you've got it there in the shop, in the box or whatever, and you're there to enthuse them to use it and come back to you more. That is in your hands. That next sale is in your hands. Sell the view, sell the product, enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as Andy said this morning, he's a big believer in selling the story behind where it's coming from. So I suppose that's a big message to take home, isn't it? When you decide to go into something like this, you're not just selling meat. You've got to sell yourself and the product and the system as well, increasingly going forward. Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Thanks ever so much, Carl, for sharing your wisdom with us. Just to reiterate what Carl said, so if you go onto the AHDB website, you want to go to the marketing tab and then trade, and then all the tools and everything that Carl's on about us can be accessed through that link. Another query that we've been getting is about following consumer trends. So we do produce a bi-monthly consumer insights newsletter. So again, straight onto our website, markets and prices, retail and consumer insight, and you'll be able to sign up to that newsletter there, and there's various other reports and things. But if you've any questions, queries, we're always here to try and answer them as best we can, as is Carl's team. So just get in touch, you'll be able to find an email address on the website. But otherwise, thank you very much for listening.